The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. Just turning 5 minutes past nine on this Tuesday, the 25th of April. I do hope you're very well indeed. Good to have you on board on this beautiful, bright, chilly but sunny morning across the Northwest. Hopefully the weather is fine where you are and you feel happy and in good health. To enjoy it. Plenty to keep you entertained over the next 3 hours, so stick with us. If you want to raise an issue, pass on some information, tell us a good story, need our help with an issue, whatever it is, 086 60 25 000, that's the WhatsApp and text number. Caroline and Niamh responding to your texts. You can call them too on 074 91 25 000, and email comments at highlandradio.com. Hop on to YouTube and watch the show, Highland Radio Ireland. Like and subscribe if you don't mind. And you can also watch us across our Facebook pages. Right, let's go on to the newspapers for this morning. The Donegal Democrat Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, opened the Donegal Town Primary Care Centre on Friday afternoon, saying it fitted into the government plan for healthcare in the country. He also claimed facilities such as this helped them get within touching distance of one of the most profoundly important pillars of a recent and dignified society, or a decent and dignified society, universal healthcare. A number of speakers, including Community Healthcare Network Manager for Donegal South and West, Samantha Ibbs, Head of Services for Primary Care, Mandy Doyle, General Manager for Primary Care, Community Healthcare, Cavan, Donegal, Leitrim, Monaghan and Sligo, Mora Gillen, and Dr. Peter Cardus of the GP practice within the centre, outlined the new role for the facility and the journey to reaching the opening. On to the Derry Journal now, to 2024 start for new kids unit. Exciting details of a proposal, a proposed new state-of-the-art paediatric department at Galvin Hospital have been made public for the first time. A significant step on the road to realising the new children's ward has been passed with the submission of a planning application for the Western Trust. A planning report compiled by TODD, Todd Architects, points out that the children's unit in the hospital is in serious need of a major enhancement and modernisation. So that's going to happen, it seems. On to the Irish Independent, just probably a story telling us what we already know. The price of electricity in Ireland is the highest in Europe, according to new research that's likely to pile pressure on the government for further relief for households. The unit price for electricity is almost double the European average, according to the major study of residential electricity prices in 33 European capital cities. Gas prices are also among the most expensive in Europe. The cost of electricity has doubled for some Irish households in the last 2 years. Now, why are our prices so high? Look at the amount of wind farms that we have here. Now, we know there are reasons and there's little arrangements and positive deals for that, but one of the arguments, the sacrifices for having this type of renewable energy, but you'd have thought, is that we can get, you know, energy at least at the same price as other places, if not cheaper. We'd obviously like cheaper. As it turns out, we're being completely gouged on the price of electricity. The findings are likely to heap further pressure on the government to provide at least the same supports again for the coming winter, just a week after a surplus of $10 billion in public finances was announced. The survey found residential electricity prices, including taxes, varied from 9.2 cent per kilowatt hour in Hungary, 9.2 cent, to 49.9 cent in Ireland. The EU average was 28.3. So if you're out there listening and you're struggling with the latest huge bill, or you're a business that has gone bust or on the brink of going bust, or you've just had to take out another bridging loan in the hope that prices might come down and you can see it through the summer. And there are businesses out there that are going to have to do that type of thing. You know, we're paying 49.9% per kilowatt in Ireland, per kilowatt hour. 9.2 cent per kilowatt hour is what they're paying in Hungary. That just is not right, is it? The survey also shows the financial supports per capita for households and firms to help cope with the price rises are lower here than in other European countries. So, as I say, if these excesses are for rainy days, there's a lot of people suffering extreme damp conditions at the moment. The Irish Times tells us that a new $1 billion housing plan due to be unveiled by Cabinet will aim to cut the cost of building homes, renovate more vacant properties and see a larger number of cost rental apartments rolled out. I hope this works. It does feel a little bit like Groundhog Day, doesn't it? Because you come on a programme like this and you read the newspapers and it's the same story, but nothing really seems to improve. Let's hope this is the one. Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, will bring a number of memos to Cabinet to expand vacant property grants, provide subvention to builders where they develop cost rental apartments, and cut the cost of building homes through waivers. As I say, fingers crossed, but you know yourself. Now, many people out there will have been following the Ditches coverage of the Niall Collins story and wondering why is it not being covered anywhere else, and we addressed that a few times on this programme. It's not a story we ordinarily would cover here anyway. It's a minister, a junior minister down the county, and it's to do with dealings in his own constituency, but that's no excuse. But the challenge for the national media, they would tell you, and to be honest with you, I understand where they're coming from, is that Niall Collins refused to comment on it. And it is the Ditch that did great work in acquiring the minutes and what have you to publish their story, but it is they that had that information and they that interpreted it, and it was they that took the risk in potentially, if the story is found to be untrue, having libeled the deputy. And then, obviously, if a programme like this reads out what they say, we're also in the hole for hundreds of thousands of euro if it turns out not to be completely accurate. I'm not doubting it for a second, but Niall Collins was very clever and he kept silent, which meant it very difficult for people who didn't have access to the same documents as the Ditch had to actually cover the story. But anyway, be that as it may, he's commented now, so more of the story is coming out. And in fairness, it was probably thanks to People Before Profit for forcing the hand of Niall Collins to release a statement. But Junior Minister Niall Collins last night denied allegations relating to a property deal involving Limerick County Council and his wife. A website The Ditch claimed Mr. Collins, a Limerick TD and former councillor, voted to dispose of council land ultimately sold to his wife, Emer O'Connor. However, in a statement last night, Fianna Fáil TD Mr. Collins said the sale of the property took place in 2008 when he was no longer a councillor. But the problem is that he was a councillor in 2007 when a vote was taken, this according to the coverage of The Ditch, when a vote was taken to allow the selling of this land to progress. And it also is claimed by The Ditch that his wife and other parties, in fairness, that's what the minutes are saying, and I can't go beyond what the minutes are saying, that his wife and other parties had, although The Ditch claims it was only one party, had expressed an interest in that land in the months prior to the vote by council, okaying it being sold, being taken. He was at that meeting. Again, this is where it gets a little bit difficult to report. As happens at council meetings, there was a proposer and a seconder, but there wasn't a vote on it as such. That doesn't always happen. So it passed without him having to vote on it. That being said, there are claims, and he'll have to address these in the Dáil, that because he must have known that his wife had expressed an interest in this land, that he should have said, look, lads, I'm going to step out from this now at the moment because there could be a conflict of interests. And in there is the accusations. He's denied them. He might have to speak about it in the Dáil today, and we'll see what kind of questions he's asked of and are asked of him and what his answers are. Gardaí are probing allegations that a top GSOC investigator attended a party with Gerry Hutch. It's the first time the force has been required to investigate the Garda Síochána Ombudsman's Commission, whose function is to investigate potential cop misconduct. Detectives are expected to interview the investigator who quit GSOC last week. The inquiry began after GSOC formally asked Garda Commissioner Drew Harris to investigate the matter. GSOC has been conducting its own internal investigations after it emerged that one of its senior investigators said he had attended a party with the monk following the acquittal last Monday of the murder of cartel thug David Byrne. It appears the GSOC member is from outside Europe and has been working for a number of years with GSOC. It will be interesting to see how that progresses. Into the Star now, and the cost of agricultural land across Ireland is expected to increase by an average of 8% this year, a survey by Auctioneers suggests. The Society of Chartered Surveyors Ireland indicated that national rental prices will rise by an average of 14%. The figures are contained in the CS SCSI, Chagas Agricultural Land Market Review and Outlook Report 2023. According to the report, which surveyed 134 auctioneers and valuers, the outlook for dairy farmers is expected to ease, while the future is challenging for sheep and tillage farmers. The 2022 average agri-land rental price in Munster and Leinster rose by 13% and 9% respectively. In Munster, prices per acre ranged from 241 for grazing only to 383 for potato crops. But there are no figures here for Ulster. They touch on Leinster, but nothing as it relates to Ulster there, unfortunately. And finally, motor insurance premiums have fallen by 5% and now average €578, we're told. The relief for motorists comes after years of soaring premium costs. This was made even worse as the cost of living crisis deepened over the past year and a half. So whilst it's being framed as good news, I think there's an argument in terms of the payouts, the cost of those payouts and so on and so forth, that I believe that it should be much lower. But anyway, I suppose any break is better than none. Figures released last week by the CSO, it's their Sexual Violence Survey 2022, showed that 40% of adults experienced sexual violence in their lifetime, including 40% of women and 28% of men. The study also showed that 22% of people aged 18 to 24 experienced sexual violence, both as an adult and as a child. We're joined on the programme now by independent TD for Donegal, Thomas Pringle. Shocking statistics, aren't they, Deputy Pringle?
Morning, Greg. Yeah, it's horrific, really, when you read it and see it. You would never think it would be so stark. And I think that the one important thing that comes out of this CSO study is the first time it has been done in Ireland, and so that there's the first real statistics that are available that are indisputable as well, I think. And so they should provide a good basis for government to set legislation on and set funding priorities for in relation to as well, because I think that's vitally important, because it's hugely important that sexual violent groups and like the Rape Crisis Centre and stuff like that there are funded adequately to meet the respond within our communities to the huge need.
Yeah, and last year we were speaking to people involved with children and they expressed their shock at a rise in sexual assaults among children. And that's reflected in these figures as well, which is important, actually, that we get the official figures. There's been a rise in sexual assaults among children naturally, nationally, with a 50% increase in victims under the age of 16 in Donegal last year alone. We really need to get to the bottom of these figures. Some concerns were expressed last year that much of this could be peer-to-peer abuse. I'm not sure if these figures are that nuanced to take account of that. But whatever is happening, we need to really get a grip on this. And money should be no option, Thomas.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like you say, Greg, we do have to get a grip of it. And, you know, when you see that the Donegal Rape Crisis Centre, and recognising that the age had reduced the age to 12 of children, people that they would see, and they had to be funded through the Late Late Toy Show, which I think is in itself says a lot about the services that we provide. And it's the irony of the fact that the Late Late Toy Show fundraiser is funding what is a horrific crime for 12-year-olds and up is just shocking, really. And I think as a society, we have to take stock of this and try and figure out what is actually happening, and ensure that we put some steps in place to make sure that the harm can be reduced. I don't think it's ever going to be able. Unfortunately, it's never going to be possible to eliminate it entirely. But I think we have to reduce the harm. And I think, from my own opinion, and I'm no expert on it, but I think one of the main things is social media and internet access as well. And unfortunately, I think a lot of young people are learning about sexual relationships and that from social media and from the internet, and unfortunately a lot of that is pornography. And you know, when you see that young people, the proliferation of smartphones and stuff like that there amongst young people, it's not possible for parents to keep an eye on what their children are doing in terms of online and that there. And I think that is contributing a huge amount to the situation that we have.
Yeah, and this is where the whole debate about what should or shouldn't be taught in schools comes into it, because what's happening at the moment, you could make a very strong argument, is that young boys and young girls, and it could work in a very negative way for both, are getting their education anyway on the internet. And it's all about, we have to protect children. That's what our number one role is as parents and just as members of society. And then you have people that resist them getting different types of information in school. As I say, you know, I understand it's divisive and confusing, but I think we all as adults need to put some stuff to one side and actually say, right, we all have a shared interest here in addressing the major, major problem that's here and historically here. Yeah. And what do we need to do right across it, be it in schools, outside schools, and whatever it might be, to limit this? Because we're you hear an awful lot of concern of what's coming down the line for children. It's right here, right now, and no one should or could ignore these figures.
That's it, Greg. You know, and I mean, I think as a parent myself, although my children are a lot older now, but you know, you do believe that it should be up to you to decide what has education. But the problem is that external factors and the environment that they live in is far passing beyond what you might like to think is the time that you should tell your children about these things. And the fact is that you could be deciding that, you know, your children don't need to know this till they're older, but they have a smartphone when they're 12 and 13, where they're learning all this stuff anyway. And so by the time that a parent decides that it might be suitable for them to learn, it's gone as far too late. And I think a lot of the discussion we have at the moment in society around teaching children around sexual relations and stuff like that there, I think we're actually starting too late, and we're looking at starting too late as well by having this discussion around transition year and third years in the tech, where it should be really, at this stage, we should be having these discussions with our children and young people when they're in national school and in sixth class.
Well, given the rate of sexual assault, it's how it's taught, you see, and this is the problem, Thomas, is that parents aren't, I don't think, properly told what's being taught or how it's being taught. You know, and people like myself, you sort of go through life with blind ignorance. You know, we need to, you know, put one of these classes on YouTube and direct parents to it and say, look, this is what we're teaching them. Yeah. What do you think, or whatever? There has to be a different way. Do you know what I mean? But people then take a post on Twitter or Facebook as to what is being taught in schools and get angry, but we don't really, the government's not communicating this properly.
Or maybe the schools could actually take the parents in and run the class with the parents and show them what they're actually
whatever it takes.
Teaching them. Yeah, because I mean, I think that's vitally important. Because funny enough, I was talking to one young woman last week around this, and she said that even the sexual education between the girls and boys in schools is completely different. And girls get far more detail and far more information, where boys are given, they're not given any information at all, and they're given very little. And you know, and the reality is, unfortunately, that sexual violence is perpetrated by men and boys. And if we want to deal with this issue and deal with it comprehensively, we need to start talking to boys and explaining to boys about what sex is and what having a proper sexual relationship is, and ensure that they know and they can have the facts.
And let's make no mistake about it. And you said this at the beginning, and it is the truth. We are not educating them with them having no knowledge at all. It's actually countering what they're accessing and learning on the internet. It's not sort of, these aren't little, and listen, we knew all the words and we were saying all the words and all the slang and all that type of stuff when I was, 10 years of age in Lahey National School, you know, and that was some time ago, you know. but my point, you know, we knew it all, or we thought we knew it all, right? So it's not about, as I say, polluting their young minds. Obviously, when it's at the right age, this is stuff that's being talked about in the playground, or they're accessing it on TikTok or YouTube or somewhere, anywhere, or it could be during a voice chat in a game of FIFA on the Xbox. Yeah. You know, we don't know what they're talking about, but you can be sure there's someone using that communication route for the wrong reasons at time.
What
role do you believe the Domestic Sexual and Gender-Based Violence Agency has in, I suppose, the fashioning of upcoming legislation? You've been speaking about that.
Yeah, the Domestic and Sexual Violence and Gender-Based Violence Agency has been established under the Istanbul Convention, which Ireland ratified over the, I think it was last year. And it's, the convention is about how we actually deal with sexual violence in society. And that there, and the intention of the bill is to create an agency that will carry out the research and like the CSO research to see what is actually needed and what can be done, and then also provide adequate funding as well, which I think is vitally important, because I don't want to see a situation where any rape crisis centre is looking for charity to provide funding to initiate very important services for young people to ensure that they can be safe. And so I think that's vitally important. And I think what the agency has to do is look at as well as the role that men and boys play and ensure that they're looking at that as well overall and providing adequate services across the board.
Okay. Thanks very much for your time this morning. Take care. That's Independent Deputy Thomas Pringle. Now, the Motor Insurers Bureau of Ireland has received 287 claims relating to road traffic collisions caused by uninsured and untraced driving in Donegal over the last 5 years. Nationally, there were over 10,000 claims submitted to the MIBI during that period. David Fitzgerald is MIBI Chief Executive and joins us now. Thanks for taking the time, David. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you too, Greg.
Right, okay. So talk to me about this class of person then and how the claim system works, just to give the figure some context for us.
Certainly. So we're a not-for-profit organisation. So what we do is we compensate the victims of accidents caused by uninsured and untraced drivers, hit-and-run accidents and uninsured drivers. The cost of those claims are fully funded by the motor insurers in Ireland. So unfortunately, what that means is over that five-year period, the average motorist will have contributed 150 to 175 euros on the cost of their policy over that time. It's a big problem. With over 10,000 claims in that period, and very high levels of uninsured driving. So we estimate that 8.3% of private motor cars in Ireland are uninsured. That's four times the EU average.
And we would hope, though it doesn't always seem to be the case, but we would hope that if we could drive this figure down and drive these number of claims down, then the burden on the policyholder would reduce, insurance would get cheaper.
Absolutely. That's what we would expect. We've been working on, I think we talked about it on the show before, we've been working on an Irish motor insurance database with our members, and we have that ready to go. Just need the legislative basis to be able to pass that to the Gardaí, which is contained in the Road Traffic and Roads Bill. So we're continuing to call on the Oireachtas to pass that bill without delay. It's been working its way slowly through the Oireachtas. It's almost there. The government expected to pass this quarter. And then what we'll be able to do is pass that database to the Gardaí, who are anxious to use it with their automatic number plate recognition technology. And that will help them to very quickly, automatically identify uninsured drivers on the road. And we're confident that'll make a big difference to enforcement. And as you say, that should start to reduce the contribution in premiums and help the honest motors.
And the reality is too, and perhaps that we made this point in our last conversation, you don't have to catch everyone doing this, but there is clearly information out there that people feel the risk is worth the reward. In other words, that they are unlikely to be caught, or they'll get away with it for a very long time, or whatever it might be. But if it is, if a certain number of people are seen to be caught, it could change that culture or those habits very quickly right across the board.
Absolutely, Greg. We're confident this type of technology has worked in other jurisdictions. It's made a big difference in the UK, for example. Our closest neighbour have had this technology for about 10 years, and it's made a big difference over time. Their uninsured driving rate is about 2.5%, and a lot of that is driven by this technology. So we feel if we give the Gardaí the tools to catch these people, it'll change hearts and minds, and people hopefully won't take the risk, because the penalties are very high if you're caught. Your uninsured vehicle will be seized at the side of the road. It's five penalty points, an automatic court appearance, and a fine of up to 5,000 euros and or 6 months in prison. So it's really not something worth risking. And if we can get the enforcement up, give the Gardaí the tools that are set out in this bill, we hope they'll start to make a big difference quickly.
Yeah, so how do people claim through the Motor Insurance Bureau of Ireland? So if I were in collision with an uninsured driver, what happens next?
So if you have a comprehensive policy, the first thing you should do is contact your own insurer, because they'll be able to assist you and repair your own vehicle. And we have an agreement that they'll do that without affecting anybody's no claims bonus. And then they'll assist you if you know if you're injured, you know, by a third party, an uninsured third party. They'll assist you in connecting you with ourselves. If you have third party insurance, you can contact us directly. So the MIBI.ie, there's an online claims form. It's very straightforward. If people want to put their details there, if they've had an accident, and we'll be able to assist you with your claim.
Yeah, and I mean, the figures will fluctuate, increase perhaps maybe as it's more difficult for people to pay bills. But as it stands, 188,000 uninsured private vehicles on Irish roads last year. That is a remarkable figure. Every time I read it, it surprises me.
It's scandalous. That's the only word for it. It's just way too high. And there's freeloaders on the back, you know, operating the backs of the honest motorists. And we need to get that down, and it'll reduce the premiums for everybody.
I know you talk about number plate recognition software, but they must feel confident that they can get through checkpoints as well for it to be on this scale. Do you know what I mean? There are checkpoints here and there, of course, not as many as some might want, perhaps more than others might want, but they must have fraudulent discs or something. I know this is, I'm not asking you to make an official comment on this, David, as such, you know what I mean, because it's anecdotal, but they must have something on the windscreens, because they're parking in car parks, they're parking in on main streets, you know what I mean? So there's something else going on here.
It's certainly possible. I'd only be speculating. You know, people might be finding ways around, as you say, to forgery, but there won't be a hiding place with this technology. Even the insurers are updating this information every night into our system. So when we can get this across to the Gardaí, you know, that had the bang up to date position. So if there was a fake disc, as you suggest, in the windscreen, that won't fool the Gardaí. And you know they're going to have this technology in all the road policing cars, and then they're rolling it out to, you know, thousands of handheld mobile devices. So they're very excited about that. I met the assistant commissioner last week, you know, to talk about the rollout and the great potential of this technology.
Yeah, it's interesting, the figures, because they are going to be skewed by very little traffic on the roads for a number of years over which they cover, but still, nonetheless, they've been published now. Very finally, sorry, any idea possibly when this database, the Gardaí might start using it for number plate recognition, and as the GDPR and data sharing hurdles been jumped at this point?
So the data sharing hurdles will be resolved by the Road Traffic and Roads Bill, and we've data sharing agreements ready to go with the Gardaí. So the plan would be, if this passes in the Oireachtas this quarter, which the government hope it will, and the bill will be enacted on the 1st of July, and then we can start that process with the Gardaí, you know, in terms of getting them the data, and they'd start to use it over the course of the second half of the year. We'll roll that out in a controlled way. Make sure you know their app is working correctly, but you know, we'll be getting it rolling this year.
All right, thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it as always. That was Chief Executive of the MIBI, David Fitzgerald. There, he wants greater enforcement and greater tools at Gardaí disposals. 086 60 25,000 WhatsApps and texts to that number. So the number of claims received in Donegal 2018 76. 2019, 69, 2020, 59, 2021, 36, 2022, 47. So there is a downward trend there, bar a blip last year. But as I say, for a number of those years, there was very few cars on the road at all, wasn't there? Right, okay. I can't make that name out there, unfortunately. Okay, we're joined on the programme now by Dylan. Thanks, Caroline. Good morning, Dylan.
How you doing, Greg?
I'm all right. Okay, your comment, your text in there, as it relates to our last conversation, or our conversation, I think, with Thomas Pringle.
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of the stuff that Thomas has said. And it's welcoming that there's a gender-based violence group there to try and look into these things. But one of the main issues I can see is that it affects border county areas mainly, is that convictions received in Northern Ireland for domestic violence are not considered as evidence at all or recognised as evidence in the Southern courts unless it's brought up in a social worker's report, which is very difficult to get the judge to agree to. So you can't say, for instance, that this affects cases where there's access to children, for example. So what it means is somebody can have a domestic violence conviction in Northern Ireland and then move across the border, short distance, and then continue their activities in the southern state, and those convictions from the north are not considered here at all. So it's like as if they have a blank canvas.
Yeah.
So it sort of protects the abuser from having a proper conviction given to them in the event that they're caught here, and it also protects them and allows them to have access to children where perhaps they shouldn't have that access because they potentially put these children at risk of exposure to violence.
So Dylan, if someone was trying to... So say, for instance, there was a court sitting in Letterkenny and someone from Armagh had a conviction. You're precluded from even mentioning that, as you say, unless it's in a...
You can mention it, but it won't be considered.
Right, so the judge or the arbiter is not allowed to actually give that any weight at all?
No, you would have to, in that instance, you would have to go and get a copy of the conviction to present to the court. Mm. So in cases where it's access to children is where it particularly affects, in actual domestic violence cases, it probably can be used if you can get a copy of the conviction. But in cases where it's access to children, even with the conviction, it's not.
I understand.
Really,
I get where you're coming from, which obviously is very concerning because you'd imagine there could be an increased risk of harm to the children.
Exactly, yeah.
I presume for those who are contesting against the person with a conviction, this is very frustrating because, you know, they may have learnt this information after some time and then they've had children with this person, but they can't use their history to protect their children. I mean, that must be very frustrating and probably more common than we think.
Yeah, and there's things that are available in the UK that are not available here. For example, they have a right to tell and a right to ask legislation there, where if you suspect that somebody is involved in domestic violence or has a conviction of domestic violence and is potentially abusing somebody else, you can go to the police and inform them that you believe that this person is a domestic abuser. They will then go and investigate to see if there's any convictions for this person. And if they find that there is, then they'll go and inform the person that they're now with to, so that at least they have the knowledge that that is the case. And they will put in place in the background, and it's like a sort of escape route or support to have the person removed from that risk if they choose to do that. So there's things there that are available in the UK that really would be good to have here as well. If we could move towards that.
Yeah, we should have it. Okay, and that legislation is going through, and hopefully, Dylan, you seem to have some good knowledge of this. You make representations to those that might have an influence on it, as it seems to be now is the time. But thank you for giving us your insights. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, no problem, Greg. Thanks.
Right, bye-bye. Take care of yourself. Pardon the language in this message, but I just want to read it out anyway. A caller says that this new this conversation effectively that they're having is nothing but a charter for the future decriminalisation of paedophilia by the back door. Any adult who wants to talk to young children about sex is a predator and a groomer. Now, the reason I've read that out is because this is the language that you'll find all over Telegram. And it kind of, I'm not questioning the motivation of it, but it's all a little bit strange in that we have a problem at the moment where an increasing number of children, historically, it's not something that happened in the last year or two, are the victims of sexual assaults and abuse. But people don't want to discuss even ways of how we address that, as if everything's okay now and that this is all a plan to make things really bad into the future. Why would someone not want us to talk about what we probably could or should do, dependent on the conversation, to protect children now? I don't understand why someone would try and scare people off by calling them predators and groomers. We're talking about the welfare of our children here. Right, okay. But anyway. Hi, Greg. It's funny you saying insurance has come down 5%. My daughter is with the same broker for a number of years and is out on her own and has come down every year. Car hasn't changed. There is no points. And this year, the insurance is dearer by 100 euro. Very peculiar. But maybe her insurance come down to such a level. I don't know. It shouldn't be, should it? But the 5% reduction is an average. And, of course, they look at things and different people in different ways. Hi, Greg. My daughter, her insurance renewal, yes, she has a full license, 14 years, no penalty points. Her insurance is 571 euro and 6 cent. That's good, but it should be lower, I think, depending on the car. Curious what car she's driving. That's about not far off what I'm paying. And right, is it illegal to take your name off the electoral register? I don't believe it is. You can deregister yourself. I don't think it's illegal. There is a process to be gone through. I'm not sure of the point or benefit of it, but there was an awful lot of talk of that, of course, around about the time when everyone was fighting over COVID. Hi, Greg. Does anyone know when the enhanced MICA scheme is starting? We're in limbo at the moment. Donegal County Council still want you to apply via the old scheme. Engineers are not taking on new customers as they tell us the new scheme is imminent. Even customers who are halfway through applications are being told their application will be transferred to the new scheme. It has gone backwards again. We can't move on. Another stumbling block created to stall us. When will this nightmare end? They ask, please highlight as you are only public voice. I don't. It was supposed to be imminently. I thought May, March, May, April. I don't know. But I know there are people listening to the programme who are right across this issue, the defective concrete block issue. And maybe one of you might text in or call in or message me to tell me at the moment what is the sense as to when the new scheme will be in place. Because as we've talked about this on numerous occasions, between the old and the new, we do seem very much to feel like we are in limbo. Right, okay. Staff at the Seagate factory in Derry are bracing themselves for job losses and pay cuts to be announced this week as the company takes what's being described as aggressive actions to lower costs. The hard drive manufacturer Seagate is the biggest employer in Derry with around 1,400 staff. Councillor Sean Harkin is a member of People Before Profit. So, Sean, good morning to you. And what exactly is going on, as much as you can determine?
Well, I mean, Seagate have issued a statement, their you know, costs and
all right, that line, Sean, that line is terrible. Can you, is there any way you could move to, or do you want us to call you back and try and get a better line?
How's that now? Is that any better?
Yep, that sounds... No, Sean, I'll tell you if No, it's fine. If you hang up, we'll try and get you on a better line because it's an important story. Is that okay, Sean? All right, take care of yourself. We'll be back with Councillor Sean Harkin shortly. One of the team will get him back up on the line. But in the meantime, let us go to more of your comments. Hi, Greg. I had my window screen cracked by loose chips on the road in the Glencar area of Letterkenny this morning. Can anyone explain why potholes in Donegal consistently have this issue? Why can potholes not be properly filled in? I don't know the answer to that. Morning, Greg. Would you please say a very happy wedding anniversary to a lovely couple in Rathmullen, Rose and Hugo Thompson. It's coming in for Molly, Drew, Grace, Isaac, Liz, William and best friend Winnie. Thank you. It's our pleasure. And there's another one here as well. Another request. I nearly mentioned this yesterday. Dear Greg, could you please play a very special request on Tuesday for Joe and Martina Diver in Remelton on their 25th wedding anniversary, and we just love them to bits. That's coming in from Daddy and Mummy. Okay, and I'll pass that on maybe to the guys later on. They can give that a mention as well. Thank you very much for taking the time to get in touch with us. And don't forget, anytime you want to play a request or have a dedication done, we do that on this show too. The usual number is 086 60 25000, or call 074 91 25000. A caller says, I recently sold some land and have to pay 33% tax on it. I was trying to call the tax office to arrange payment of 10,000 euro. Everything pushes you online. I'm not in any way capable of being online, and trying to call is impossible. You're only given a few hours on a certain day to call. I've written to them by post because I can't do email. Can any of your listeners tell me how people get in touch with Revenue? They want to pay a bill. revenue trying to push them online. Someone out there is bound to have a solution to that. Please get in touch with us. Now, hopefully, we've a better connection now with Councillor Sean Harkin. Sean, can you hear me okay?
I can indeed.
All right, that's lovely. Right, so, okay, when did concerns start to become apparent around Seagate in Derry? As we said, it's the area's biggest employer in Derry, that is.
Yeah, I think over the last week, there's been a lot of speculation about potential redundancies and wage cuts. And unfortunately, the company hasn't actually intervened to provide any kind of clarity. So our first appeal would be to the company to, you know, give as much clarity to workers as possible as to what's happening. And as you can imagine, Seagate is a big employer in Derry in the Northwest. A lot of people depend on it. And you know, people are very worried. And you know, we've had in the last couple of weeks, we've had the, you know, U.S. envoy from the American government here, Joe Kennedy, mm-hmm. talking about the potential for investment into across Ireland and in the north. He met with Seagate. There was no word of any of this during those discussions. So I think people are a bit shocked. And look, you know, workers there have done absolutely nothing wrong. I mean, you know, Seagate's been good for Derry, that's often said, but Derry has been very, very good to Seagate as well. They've been very profitable over the last three decades. They posted huge profits in the last couple of years. And, I mean, this is coming off the back of a well-reported and well-documented $300 million fine that the US government has imposed on Seagate for violating, you know, US trading with Chinese companies. So the US government says that Seagate, violated national security, and there's a $300 million fine. And that led them to a drop in Seagate share prices. And so they are now, it seems to me, scrambling to deal with this, you know, huge mismanagement by the CEO and by Seagate corporate. And I don't think, and I think most people would agree that, you know, workers here in Derry and elsewhere shouldn't be carrying the can for a serious, serious mistake that the company has made. I mean, look.
I mean, is it? Can you attribute it to that, Sean? And I get it, and I see the logic. But the kind of a payment deal where, and it seems small fry, really. They're paying it off $15 million a quarter for the next 5 years. That I'm not saying that's not substantial, but what we are seeing right across tech, and this falls into that category, I presume, is tech companies that are profitable, that are doing well. Using or not using necessarily, or maybe it's the reality, the current climate to cut staff. You know, we're seeing 10, 15% staff cuts across the likes of Facebook, Twitter. Well, Twitter is a different story altogether, but Google, do you know what I mean? We are seeing these tech companies, as I say, using this period of time to slim down their workforce. So, as I say, I think you could be perfectly right in the finding against them, but unfortunately, maybe this was on the cards anyway.
Yeah, look, I think that there's a number of factors at play here. I mean, it is the case that their orders have been down and that I think they reached a kind of a height of orders during the pandemic, you know, when people were globally on their computer more, locked at home. And that's kind of tailed off a bit. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's unfortunate that that the consequences of kind of restructuring will lead to people losing their job. Because I think that the company should be doing everything it can, right, to protect its workforce, who has worked for it right through the pandemic, went into work when other people were at home and able to avail of the government scheme. That wasn't the case at Seagate. Those workers went in every single day and delivered huge profits. And I look at the finances of Seagate, and anybody can do this online. You can do it yourself. They have generated huge revenues, huge profits. They're still doing massive payouts to shareholders. So, yes, you're right. There is a number of factors at play here, but I think that this goes to the heart of, like, you know, they need to be protecting their workforces. I mean, we're still in a cost of living crisis.
Yeah.
To leave people unemployed right now or even cut people's salary is so unfair. So, look, We think that all the political parties here, and that would include, I would include parties over the border,
yeah,
because
for sure.
there is Donegal workers, mm-hmm. should be united in lobbying Seagate to protect its workforce. And, you know, those phone calls need to be made to Joe Kennedy for him to have these discussions with Seagate. And obviously that should go right up to President Joe Biden, because they've just been here. They've talked about their commitment to Ireland. They've talked about their commitment to Derry in the northwest, and this would go in the opposite direction. So I
but you know
think
what they'll say? They'll say that the northwest is very important to us. You know, the staff are part of our success, but given the current situation, as we're seeing right across tech, we're going to have to consolidate to ensure the future of certain amount of jobs and the company's viability, blah, blah. You know yourself, Sean, I could write the press release right now, ChatGPT could write it for them. That being said, what they're saying so far seems to be that they want to get this done and dusted really, really quickly by the end of this quarter. So what does that mean in terms of negotiations, or what kind of input unions or staff themselves might have into this? Because we simply don't know what Seagate might come up with.
Well, yeah, look, in terms of a union, you know, there's been around 550 workers that have joined Unite the Union in the last year. And that was very much in response to company was making massive profits, and the workers were given a way below, their pay increase was below, way below inflation. And so people basically thought, look, we need a union to try and have a collective voice. But a union as well is not only for asking for pay raise, it's to actually be part of negotiations. If there is a potential for redundancies, if there is potential wage cuts, unfortunately the company, even though it has signed up to different agreements globally about recognising, agreeing workers have the right to join a union, when workers reach a certain threshold, the company turned down the opportunity to allow voluntary trade union recognition. So the union is now applying for statutory trade union recognition, which is the way the law works here in the north. Mm-hmm. If you get 50% plus one, you automatically get trade union recognition. So that's something that's currently happening. And I would say, look, my message to Seagate workers would be to join the union, and because you need a collective voice right now. Mm-hmm. This is exactly why you need to have a way of negotiating with the company over, whatever they're planning to do in terms of restructuring.
Okay,
sure. Otherwise, you're basically left at the mercy of, decisions that are being made in an executive office.
All right, Sean. Listen, thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks for keeping us updated on that. That's Councillor Sean Harkin, People Before Profit.